Hello and welcome to another episode of Gemstone Mine. I'm John.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Jake.
And we got another great episode planned for you today. We're going to talk about one of the most difficult skills to have in all of Magic, but probably doubly so, triply so, God, a lot more so in Commander, and that is Threat Assessment. This is a format that is one of the hardest skills to master in the game, and it just gets even harder when you have three opponents to manage instead of just one. But before we get on to the main topic, we've got a little bit of news. This week has started Kaldheim previews. As someone who just this year finally got around to playing the most recent God of War game and seeing all of that Norse mythology, as a longtime fan of Thor in the Marvel Universe, this is looking pretty cool.
So far, I'm more excited about the method in which they chose to unveil everything, with the heavy metal groups showcasing cards, than I am about any of the cards they've revealed so far. But there are hints of a lot of good stuff to come from it, you know, notably elves make a return, which I'm excited about. But having bands like Mastodon and all that just debut heavy metal cards and really leaning into that heavy metal Norse Viking metal is actually really cool.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to see how what the Magic take on this setting will be. We've already seen some Berserker Angel things in black, which that's pretty cool.
It definitely looks pretty cool with some of the tribes that they're looking at. They've also so far spoiled one of the new gods, who is going to be one of those modal double-faced cards with the legendary creature on the front half and then the legendary equipment on the back half. So a different take on what we saw with the pairing of legendary equipment and legendary creature that we saw in the original Theros set. So they're making good on their threat for those modal double-faced cards being in every set.
I think these are the first gods that are also not in some way unkillable, which is kind of amusing because of the whole Ragnarok, the gods are all going to die anyway type of thing.
That's fitting.
It does look like Shapeshifter is going to be a big type for this expansion, which is going to be interesting as well.
It was the glue that held Lorwyn together, so it certainly makes sense with it, and it allows them to focus on just a handful of tribal synergies as opposed to making it the headline of the entire set. Definitely looks pretty cool, and some of the preview cards are interesting. In terms of games we've played since last we talked, Alex and I got together with one of our local friends. Shout out to Luke. If you're listening to this episode, we got to play some Sealed with Commander Legends. Alex, how did did my face feel when you were grinding it into dust beneath Kolfinor's mighty roots?
Which time? We drafted two whole boxes of Commander Legends, and I drafted Kolfinor.
No, we did not draft. We did not draft. Say it proper. We did a sealed.
We did sealed, and I played Kolfinor both times.
Yes, you did. Oh, it was... So the second game in particular, you just ground out the value so freaking hard, and you held onto the Monarch for like 15 turns. Yeah, there's no coming back from that.
It is worth noting that the largest chance you guys had of actually beating me in the late game was me decking myself.
Yeah, exactly. Those were some good games, though. And we're hoping to get another couple of boxes in and potentially do either like a whole box sealed or like a boxing league kind of thing that they've been talking about. It should be interesting.
Because of everything going on with COVID and how... like, rarely we actually get a chance to get together and whatnot. I'm looking forward to just a whole box sealed between you, me, Luke, and if we can get someone else to, you know, join in this ridiculousness. But I'm curious to see what kind of 100-card shenanigan deck we can build with an entire box of Commander Legends.
Jake, hurry up.
It's going to be ridiculous.
Yeah, hurry up and move down here, Jake.
It's going to be ridiculously great.
Well, speaking of ridiculously great, let's talk about our ridiculously great episode. Let's talk about threat assessment in Commander. So let's start with the basics. What is a threat? Jake,
I would say a threat is either another opponent attempting to win or directly impacting your chance to win.
All right. That certainly makes sense then. Alex, how do you define threat?
That's the most concise way of putting it. A threat to me is what's going to derail the game from its current trajectory, ideally being my trajectory, in the long run.
You guys have both kind of put it better than I think I could put it. So basically, these threats are something that's going to, I think, derail the game is a really good way to put it, because it's pointing to those really high impact ones. And Jake kind of saying this is one of your opponents threatening to end the game, or I guess Alex appending it to derail the game in their own direction. And as we've kind of seen in Commander, we're seeing some very high impact potential threats that could be hitting the table. So when we're looking at these threats, we need to kind of decide how we actually answer them. And this is probably one of the biggest discussions and biggest hair-pulling sessions that players have. And each person around the table can have such a different view of the board of what's a threat and what is not, just with the hidden information of what cards we are holding in our hands alone. For example, during our Commander Sealed game last week, Alex, I was deeply frustrated when I played my only way to get the Monarch in a hand that basically that was my only source of card advantage. And then the next turn, the next player in order played Jared Karthalion and then handed you the Monarchy. I was like, why? You didn't? No, I needed that. But he said, well, no, knowing what's in my hand, I'm pretty sure I can get the Monarch back.
And then he didn't read his card.
Oh, yeah. Then he realized that Jared Karthalion did not let him attack on the same turn. So what are some ways that we can decide, you know, how do we actually assess a threat? Are we assessing the opponent as a threat? Are we assessing individual cards as threats? How do you guys approach it? Alex, how do you approach threat assessment?
I think the biggest thing actually is determining what it is you're trying to do and what it is you're playing and kind of going from there.
Okay.
There'll be game plans where if someone's playing an aggressive like deck, so if I'm sitting there playing, the new Akiri deck that I have with tons of equipment and Voltron, stuff like that. Playing enchantments that limit how many spells I can play per turn, how many creatures I can attack with per turn, to me, that's an immediate threat. That's causing my board state to not be able to develop the way I'd like it to. However, players that, you know, choose more grindy games, more combo-centric games, or have similar goals to another player at the table, that might not register as a threat. So the biggest thing with threat assessment, at least for me, is trying to figure out what I want to do. And then from there, seeing what players are playing that's going to stop me from doing that. Now, that being said, there are obviously universal threats out there. If he were legal in Commander, Grizzlebrand would be an excellent example of this is a threat to everybody. You should kill it.
Grizzlebrand.
Razaketh is one of those. And to a lesser extent, even though they aren't immediately threatening, they are threatening in the long term. Prophet of Kruphix, Oracle of Moldaya, Seedborn Muse, cards like that normally cause a little, the spider senses to tingle. Like,
Prophet of Band.
Prophet of Band as well, yes. But I mean, it's a good example of a card that on the surface does not look immediately threatening, but was so enough to where it either drew removal constantly or everyone needed to have a copy of it so much so that they actually banned the card.
Jake, what do you think? What defines a threat for you? How do you analyze threats?
Usually pretty poorly.
Don't be modest.
I agree with him.
So. Generally, I prefer to be in the seat of producing the threats because I find that easier and my brain doesn't like to do too much work. So ideally, I can just throw out the threats and make other people answer me. So with that in mind, the threats are usually disruptive elements, things that would prevent me from furthering my game plan.
So I think both of you kind of hit on a similar point in what you were talking about, was identifying your own game plan, then what gets in the way of it. And we've talked about those basic deck strategies of whether you're the focused end of things or you're on the value end of things. And if you're on the focused end of things, things that are preventing you from closing out the game now, those are probably the bigger threats to your game plan than for a value deck, seeing that you can only draw one card per turn because of Narset. I don't think the focused deck really cares that Narset sits the field, for example.
No. Realistically, the biggest is a threat card, or cards, I should say, that are probably running around now, pre-Hull Breacher and Craven Mind Sensor, were Thrasios and Timna, because of just the respective advantages that they give. Neither one of them, well, Thrasios 10, technically win the game if he hits the board if you've got unbounded mana into him. But it's one of those things to where if it's all turn one, turn two of the game, and either of those two cards come down and no one's fully deployed where they are yet, they tend to draw hate relatively quickly. And one of the things that you've heard us, myself anyways, mention many times through our previous podcast is, oh, it blocks Timna. There's a reason why this is a standard. If you can't necessarily kill it, if you can block it, that kind of accomplishes the same thing. But it's weird to see how, like, trends kind of... I mean, this is a good example between competitive commander and then normal commander in terms of what's threatening versus what isn't. Like, you sit down at a completely casual table, how threatening is Timna versus sitting down at a competitive table and playing Timna?
Oh, I've still had Timna hated off the table very, very quickly in my very derpy Abzan Angels deck, where Timna was basically there as a lifelink trigger and as a card draw trigger because my cards cost a million mana. I think correctly hated off the table, too.
And then you've got cards. So where would you guys rate Dockside Extortionist in terms of threat assessment?
Kill it with fire. Hope you're packing Root Maze. Root Maze stock has gone up. And make sure you have your good old-fashioned Null Rod, and make sure you're also packing a Collector Oof.
There are multiple decks out and more that are being brewed that basically just hinge solely on Dockside. So yeah, it's kind of a big deal.
It is the season of Dockside.
It's the year of the Dockside. So let me throw out a suggested heuristic then. A couple months ago, the EDH Reccast had an episode about threat assessment, and they discussed threat assessment and commander. One of the hosts, Joey Schultz, introduced the idea of RID, R-I-D, and saying that this is kind of his heuristic that he uses when he's trying to decide what to keep, what should stay, what does he have to answer. And those were R, how replaceable is the threat? Is this something where this is the only thing in the deck that does it, like Dockside Extortionist? Or is this something that they have like 10 different iterations of in the deck? Like, this is a deck that's going to be running Propaganda, and it's going to run Ghostly Prison, and it's going to run Sphere of Safety, and all these other cards. Next, how immediate is the threat? Is this the type of threat that's going to come down and threaten to end the game this turn, next turn, 10 turns from now? If you've got a few turns to kind of suss out an answer to it, it's probably less needing removal instantly, as opposed to something that's threatening to win the game on the spot. And then the last letter, D, stood for direction. And which direction is the threat heading? In our own play group, we've seen Greven's going to start swinging, but Greven can still only swing at one person at a time around the table. On the other hand, a certain mad cow, Neheb, didn't really matter which direction he swung. Once he started swinging, we were probably going to eat some comet storms or some earthquakes or some other horrible things were probably going to happen to everybody. And knowing which direction things were going in, that certainly informed kind of our approach to how we wanted to answer things. What do you guys think of this heuristic?
It's open to interpretation. I mean, and some of them kind of resound more closely with me than the other. I mean, they all make sense. So it's the heuristic is, you know, how replaceable is it? For the most part, decks will be running effects to where they'll... I mean, if it's the winning goal, if it's the winning strategy, they're going to have redundancies for it. Either it itself is going to have a redundant-like effect, or they'll have ways to recur it. So, I mean, if we'll harken back to Razaketh on this one. If Razaketh is somehow removed from the game, is, you know, it's killed, short of being exiled, they've got animation spells to just bring it back, and oh, here we are again. Me, personally, as a player, the immediate threat is the one that I kind of least interact with, because most of my decks tend to go grindy, and I try and just plan for those threats. I also don't... I habitually don't play blue, so it's not like I can really respond to those things at instant speed anyways. But it's... I think like the more replaceable a threat is, the less of a threat it is. So, for example, like when we played our Winota game, and I was just dropping stacks effects, these Rule of Law effects, Deafening Silence, things like that. How important was it to get Deafening Silence off the board if I had that effect multiplied by like 3? Is it still threatening, or is at this point kind just like, oh, well, this is the life we live now. Everybody plays one spell a turn, and that's just new direction. At what point in time does the threat shift?
As a rule of thumb, I think it's a pretty good way to approach it. For replaceable, immediate, and direction. As far as the replaceable threats, there's a lot of decks that are based solely on their commander. So as long as you have some way of taking them off of that plan, a lot of these decks will just literally do nothing. This can be exile effects. A lot of decks, it can also be stealing effects, like the Gilded Drake and
control other magic for those of us who are not millionaires.
Yeah. So, like stealing a Gitrog can usually set that deck back a little bit.
Even some lower powered decks. Like if we were to control magic on Rin and Ciri Inseparable, those poor puppies and cats are looking a lot less threatening when they don't bring a friend with them every time.
Or Oubliette on Grevin. It's just, you're done. You literally can't do anything else anymore.
You can feed the swarm. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
But the Grevin's a good example of, direction is for the most part. Like, I've played against both of your Grevin decks in the past. And so long as I had some path and or swords-like effect or some effect to, like, goad Grevin to not come at me, I didn't necessarily care about Grevin. I could honestly care less. Especially if I wasn't the next biggest threat at the table and you two were just, like, punching each other with, like, Grevin bros. That's fine. There's no threat at this table immediately or directed at me.
So I guess one thing then that we should talk about that the heuristic doesn't really cover is not just like what cards are threatening, because I think learning all of the combos and what is the good cards and what are the two card combos that can end the game in Commander, that could be an entire like semester course at a college to really cover everything in depth. And we don't have time for that. So are there things that, do you ever take into account like the player's position? Does that change your threat assessment?
Position as in, like, turn order, or...
Or their board state, or what they've been up to, does that change your threat assessment? Like, if a person, for example, let's say that we're sitting down at a game, we got a four-player pod going on, and I have, I don't know, let's say I've cast two tutors so far, but the only thing I have on the battlefield is a couple lands, some mana rocks, and a carpet of flowers. Does that seem different? Am I more or less threatening compared to the person to my right when Alex is get the Winota train going on? He's got those three goblin tokens and the mana to cast Winota next turn.
So what kind generally, of generally, if people are not actively playing to the board and doing things to progress their game state, I will just assume they're sandbagging and that they've got something in their hand that they're trying to save for after everybody blows all their interaction on the current threat. So I think in general, it's best not to discount anybody.
Okay. What about you, Alex? What do you think? What makes somebody seem more threatening to you?
It probably has to do with how often I played with them. Like, okay. So if I were sitting down with you, me, and two strangers at a table, I would automatically peg you as the biggest threat.
Gee, thanks.
Regardless of what deck you were playing. So if you sat down with Oketra, which, according to you is one of your weaker decks, it's still a threat because while it is weak, quote-unquote, in terms of its mana cost and the fact that it's being mono-white, it's still incredibly synergistic, and if left alone, which people are wont to do to mono-white decks with expensive commanders, a turn will quickly come across where being hit for, like, 96 by cats and zombies and whatnot. But for the most part, I guess it depends on what it is harkens back to what I'm trying to do and what it is they're doing. But there are certain cards, and honestly, this comes from you specifically, just like Scrap Trawler, for example. If I'm sitting down at any table and someone plays a card that I'm familiar with because of our interactions, I'm immediately just going to, in the back of my mind, just jot down, like, shenanigans are coming from this deck.
So there's certain cards, then, that kind of raise your suspicion that something's going on and threat is higher than it may otherwise appear.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty fair. Yeah,
But I normally don't play reactive decks. I play my mid-range decks. I play my stacks decks, Blood Pod, Winota, things of that nature. So my mind necessarily doesn't go to, like, oh, what's someone holding in their hand? What's they're holding back? My whole board state game plan is to make sure that you can cast as few of those as possible per turn. So, I mean, I really don't care what you have in your hand. I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and you're going to have to answer me if you want to do what it is you want to do. In a very slow, plodding, grindy pace.
How about you, Jake?
Yes.
I play black. Is Adnaz well, a threat?
Well, Adnaz is definitely a threat. If someone passes with five mana up or you know, five black and a blue for protection, they are public enemy number one.
So here's a question, Jake, as our resident Adnaz player. Not that you don't play it, John, but Jake will find any excuse to put it as his commander. Who would be more of a threat to you? Someone playing a deck like Winota or Bloodpod like myself, or someone playing something relatively aggressive where they're pressuring your life total constantly?
Yeah, I think that would probably be just up to what's going on in the actual game. But that does remind me of something. When I first started playing, I basically, when in doubt, I would attack the blue player. because, you know, whatever, they've got something going on. But that's definitely morphed to attacking the black player, because they're usually going to be using their life as an actual resource, so you're able to pressure their life total. To deny them resources in the future.
That's true.
So, I mean, as good rule of thumbs, always attack the black player and always disrupt the hand of the blue player.
Pretty fair. I mean, we don't do a lot of hand disruption, I guess, as much in Commander. So I had a few thoughts on like what might make a player's board position seem more threatening. Like all the things being equal, if you have two other players who have basically otherwise identical, but one of them has seven cards in hand and one of them has three cards in hand, in my mind, the person with more cards in the hand is more of a threat, right?
Yeah.
With all the other things equal, yeah.
All right. And I would also say, like, tutors. If all other things are equal again, but someone has tutored three times, the other person hasn't tutored at all, I would also say that they seem to be a higher threat overall.
Yeah, once something has been tutored, they move up the scale as to what's immediately going to come down to kind of mess with the board.
Yeah, I would assume that if they're tutoring, then they're getting, you know, something relevant and good for the stage of the game. They're
yeah.
not going to, like, blow a demonic tutor on an uncastable, unplayable card that will not help them.
Yeah, and it's one of the hard lessons, I think, that we have to learn in this format, because it's very easy to say, I'm not too worried that, you know, Alex has got Korvald going on over there. He's not really hurting me with it. He's drawing cards. He's drawing six cards a turn. That doesn't hurt me. It really does. The lesson that I had to learn from this is, sure, he's drawing eight cards every turn, but he's not hurting me. The lesson that I got beat into my head in one of the old stores that I went to up in New Jersey was, yes, he is. And each card that son of a beep draws is another nail in your beeping coffin.
Tells how
strong
you really
feelings.
Feel.
It's just one of those critical things where, yeah, someone who is sculpting their hand or drawing a ton of cards or putting a lot of lands into play, all of those where they're getting ahead on resources, we really should, if we're being true to threat assessment, those are things that we probably should be regarding as more threatening overall.
I mean, if you look at Greven and the way Greven grows and becomes threatening, you use effects, Greven get big, Greven punch face. Korvold is a bit similar. He's a bit harder to cast, being three colors instead of two, but Korvold get more bigger and punch face, but Korvold also draws you cards. So there's one of those. So getting something big, getting a giant stick and aiming at somebody is fine. Getting a giant stick and aiming at somebody while also drawing a bunch of cards, that's a bit more threatening.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah, just because somebody is not presenting in-game actions, like affecting the board, does not mean they're not still planning to win. Presumably, if you're playing, you have a game plan.
Right. And I think part of the reason I wanted to talk about this too was, I know we have all had situations where we felt frustrated, like, hey, I'm not the threat here. The person over there who just drew 27 cards, that's the real threat. Yes, I have this, you know, 10-10 creature, but I've got one card in hand. Don't worry about me. Go after that person over there. Only to find out that the reason that player wasn't really was going after me the whole time was, well, yeah, but I was planning on having everybody discard their whole hand next turn and draw three cards, so I wasn't too worried about that. This whole imperfect information thing is, it really makes threat assessment so, so difficult. But having some kind of an idea of how you approach threat assessment, just some kind of a basic plan, I just think it's one of the most important skills you can have if you're trying to up your game in Commander.
Definitely. And it's not one of those things that you can just, like, teach. Like, it has to be...
the school of hard knocks.
I mean, essentially, yeah.
You gotta live it. You gotta learn it. You gotta do it. And you gotta do it again and again and again.
I think it's important to also keep in mind that if somebody makes a play that you don't agree with, don't assume that they're an idiot. Like, assume that they're working off of information you don't have, or they might not be as familiar with things as you are, or whatever, but just roll with it. Like, you don't need to get upset at people for playing the game.
Yeah, that is a really, really good point. Well, if there's no final thoughts, then why don't we call this episode kind of to a close earlier? But maybe before we do, we'll do a quick hot seat question to wrap up 2020. So one possible hot seat question that I had was, there have been a lot of really interesting mechanics explored by wizard designers in the past couple of years. And as we've switched from the old paradigm of three sets in a block to then two sets in a block, then down to just kind of single standalone sets, a lot of the experimenting with those mechanics, they weren't really fleshed out a whole lot. Probably famously, and probably for the good of the game as a whole, energy, for example, has not been revisited after it terrorized how many seasons of Standard. So the hot seat question I have for you guys is, if there were one of those mechanics that so far has not gotten there just because there aren't enough cards for it, but they could then get you enough cards to be able to build a commander deck around it, what would that mechanic be?
My default choice for any effect that is no longer prevalent that could always come back and make an interesting deck is and always will be banding.
Go away.
How about a serious answer?
Listen, as someone that likes token decks and going wide and things of that nature, banding is the natural answer for me.
Except that it's not, because then your entire band of tokens gets blocked by 1/1 and good night. You've accomplished nothing.
Yeah, but it fills the whole fantasy vibe of what I'm trying to do.
To get stopped by a Saproling?
I mean, listen, if Emrakul can be stopped by a bunch of squirrels, there's no reason why a Saproling can't stop an army of elves.
All right, Alex, you have chosen banding as the mechanic you want to see come back. I think that's like an 11 on the storm scale at the moment, but okay. Alex has said we want a banding deck.
So I think for mine, I will go with Splice, because I always thought that was a pretty cool mechanic that just happened to be doomed to being in one of the least popular sets. I did like the take on it for what master set was that? Double Masters? Or
no, not Double Masters. Not Ultimate Masters.
Oh god, there's too many.
Hang on. Because there was a card that was like a splicer card.
Yeah, it was funny because it was the Golem Splicer. So it made golems and you could also splice it.
It was Splicer Skill. So it was Modern Horizons.
Okay,
that one. So this was splice onto instant or sorcery for 3 and a white. Splicer's skill normally costs 2 and a white, and it made a 3/3 colorless golem artifact creature, but you could also cast it as part of another spell by splicing it onto an instant or a sorcery. As you cast an instant or sorcery spell, you may reveal this card from your hand and pay its splice cost. If you do, add this card's effect to that spell.
So it was a form of card advantage for colors that usually struggle with that. Also just kind of promotes spellcasty type of things, which I kind of enjoy. I don't know, I just thought it was a pretty cool mechanic, and it's nice to see that they did at least do another take on it, so it's not just splice onto Arcane, they made splice onto instant or sorcery.
Yeah, I would like to see that one come back. I mean, I didn't hate Kawagama. I just so happened to stop playing for like the fifth time after the Champions of Kawagama set. More just drifted away from the game, and I don't know. People were sick of the game after Mirrodin Block and the great gray blob that was Artifacts and Affinity at that point. I would not.
All my other options would be just, you know, give me more broken cards, some Storm, some Delve, some Dredge, you know, just any of that good stuff. But I think Splice is... I don't think there's any good Splice cards right now. I just think it's an interesting mechanic that I would like to see revisited.
So, since I've been shamed into banding and, you know, being talked down about it, even though I think that with a couple of word changes and clarification, it could work. If I had to pick another one that is more reasonable, sirs, than banding, it'd probably be Radiance.
Okay, so Radiance was the Boros mechanic from the original Return to Ravnica, the original Ravnica block, not even Return to Ravnica.
Yeah. Yep, it's from Ravnica City of Guilds, the introduction of the Ravnica plane. And Radiance is target creature and each other creature that shares a color with it is impacted by, you know, your abilities. So in decks that are monocolored or two-colored or, you know, elves, Radiance cards would be a neat one. And there are some that still see fringe play in white decks, which is like, hey, all my white creatures have protection from blank now just because Radiance is a thing. Ha! It'd be cool to see a bit more of that.
Be sure to check out our first Hidden Gems episode as we discuss one of those Radiance cards, for example. Shameless shill. Oh, I like Radiance too. That'd be pretty sweet. Actually, the one that I would want to see explored a little bit more has been fairly prominent in Standard recently because, as Jake suggested with Splice, it represents a form of card advantage in a lot of colors that don't normally get it, and that would be the adventure mechanic. I just found it very interesting stapling, essentially separating the end of the battlefield effect of a creature onto a separate spell, and then having a perfectly serviceable creature that you could then cast after you used that instant or sorcery adventure attached to it. There were quite a few of them that looked like they were right at the fringe of making quite a few of my decks, but haven't really made it just yet. But I'd like to see more cards like that that are available that can fill multiple roles in a deck. So far, I think the only one that I'm playing in any decks is Brazen Borrower, and I would like to see more of them because it's just a cool mechanic, cool way to use get more uses out of cards.
Yep, I can agree with that.
All right, guys. Well, we got our talk about threat assessment done. If we're talking about threat assessment, I think that means next time we have to talk about something that the companion to threat assessment, and that is we got to talk about answers. We got to talk about interaction next time. So that's what you're going to have to look forward to next time in 2 weeks when we get back for our full-length audio episode. Until then, guys, have a great and safe holiday season out there. However you celebrate your holidays, do so safely, do so happily. So until next time, I'm John.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Jake.
You can reach the crew from Gemstone Mine on Twitter at GemstoneMineMTG or send us an email at GemstoneMinePodcast@gmail.com. On YouTube, we're Gemstone Mine Podcast. Be sure to like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell.